The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on November 7, 1990 at Bhaktivedanta Manor, England. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 9th canto, 4th chapter, 29th verse.
Mukakuruti vachalang pangulang ayate giring at kipatamahang bande sigurum dinatadinang paramanandhumadhavam si chaitamishwaram.
I apologize for the unavoidable time of departure and for your, thank you for your mercy in allowing me the opportunity to serve. Giving the Bhagavatam birth to be purified. Text 29, chapter 4, canto 9, Srimad Bhagavatam, in the chapter entitled Ambarish Maharaj Offended by Durvasa Muni, 7th of November 1990, London, Gaurabda 504.
Arirada Ishu Krishna Mahisha Tulyasilaya Yukta Sangvatsarang Viro Dadhara Dvadasi Vratam Ariradaishu Krishnam Mahisha Tulyasilaya Yukta Sangvatsarang Viro Dadhara Dvadasi Vratam Ariradaishu. Aspiring to worship Krishnam, the Supreme Lord Krishna, Mahisha, with his queen, Tulya, Silaya, who was equally as qualified as Maharaj Ambarisha, Yukta, together, Sangvatsaram, for 1 year, Vira, the king, Dadhara, accepted, Dvadasi Vratam, the vow for observing Ekadasi and Dwadasi. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Abhay Charanaravinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. To worship Lord Krishna, Maharaj Ambarish, along with his queen, who was equally qualified, observed the vow of Ekadasi and Dwadasi for 1 year. Translation with repetition. To worship Lord Krishna, Maharaj Ambarisha, along with his queen, who was equally qualified, observed the vow of Ekadasi and Dwadasi for 1 year. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. To observe Ekadasi Vrata and Dwadasi Vrata means to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Those interested in advancing in Krishna consciousness must observe Ekadasi Vrata regularly. Maharaj Ambarisha's queen was equally as qualified as the king. Therefore, it was possible for Maharaj Ambarisha to engage his life in household affairs. In this regard, the word Tulya Silaya is very significant. Unless a wife is equally as qualified as her husband, household affairs are very difficult to continue. Chanakya Pandit advises that a person in such a situation should immediately give up household life and become a vanaprastha or sannyasi. Mata yasya grihe nashti bharja chapriya vadini aranyam tena gantabhyam yataranyam tatha griham. A person who has no mother at home and whose wife is not agreeable with him should immediately go away to the forest. Because human life is meant for spiritual advancement only. One's wife must be helpful in this endeavor. Otherwise, there is no need of household life. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta Swami translation and purport to text 29, chapter 4, canto 9 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a very, very strong verse regarding the duties and the nature of a Krishna conscious grihastha relationship. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who of course practiced Krishna consciousness as a grihastha in the grihastha ashram for most of his lifetime, he explained that what is the definition or the definition of grihastha life. Said that a Krishna conscious grihastha is someone who uses the sense of, who has the all the senses, touch, hearing, tasting, seeing, smelling, all of the senses plus the mind are fully engaged in all varieties of activities, but simply with the purpose of pleasing Krishna. And such a Krishna conscious grihastha also is married to an equally qualified Krishna conscious spouse. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur considered that to actually have a grihastha ashram, it required that both husband and wife have to be Krishna conscious. Otherwise, it's the individual who's practicing Krishna consciousness along with someone else in the household. And according to Chanakya Pandit, in the verse cited here by Srila Prabhupada, that yata aranyam tata griham, if somebody is in the house and the spouse is not Krishna conscious, then living in the house or living in the forest is not different. Yata aranyam, just like living in the forest, tata griham, it's the same in the house. There's no advantage. Someone thinks if I live in a grihastha situation, I have these protections, I'll have this kind of peaceful situation where I can practice my Krishna consciousness. But if the spouse is not Krishna conscious, he won't get that peace. A very strong recommendation by Chanakya Pandit and by Srila Prabhupada. Then in such a circumstance, you might as well, what's the use of staying home if it's going to be as hellish as... Because living in a renounced life means a lot of tests. There's a lot of austerities one has to endure. But similar austerities will be there in the household. But in the household with a non-Krishna conscious spouse, it won't be possible to be Krishna conscious very easily. Well, on one's own, it may be more possible. So, of course, I've seen in advising different devotees how often they misunderstanding about, you know, different between the different couples. Sometimes they come and ask questions. Of course, Srila Prabhupada advised that sannyasi shouldn't really get involved in marriage counseling as such, apart from just a purely philosophical basis. We see that sometimes the misunderstanding comes in what is the role of the other person, and because of the dissatisfaction with the activities of the other person, especially in terms of their material abilities to maintain, protect, and so on. But here we see that Bhagavatam places the first criteria to the spouse's being Krishna conscious. That is the first thing we see. That is the most important aspect. You can see in the life of Ramanuja Acharya, he was a grihastha, and he was teaching and preaching. And in order to advance in his Krishna consciousness, he had accepted a spiritual master. It so happened that his spiritual master was also a grihastha. So he invited his guru to live in his house so that he could study directly under the guru and serve the guru. The guru was before living in Srirangam, and Ramanuja was staying in Kanchipuram in Tamil Nadu, today's Tamil Nadu, South India. Both these places are famous because of very great temples. The temples are great because the deities are very active and very merciful. They have performed unlimited miracles with their devotees. In Kanchipuram, Lord Varadaraja, and in Srirangam, Ranganatha, Krishna deity, two-handed form lying down. The deity that was personally worshipped by Sri Ram. It so happened that Ramanuja's wife didn't really come up to the standard of Krishna consciousness of Ramanuja, or try to understand. In South India, the life of Ramanuja is recorded in the different pictures in the temples, and it's revealed that he told his wife that, "I'll remain with you my whole life. We'll serve Krishna together, engage in our household life, but as long as you don't offend any Vaishnavas. If you offend the Vaishnavas, then I'll give two chances. There won't be a third chance, then I'll go." So, in following this system, apparently one day at the water well, in those days there wasn't running water, so everyone would go to the same well and lift water from the bucket with a rope and fill their water jugs and take it back for the household duties. So the guru's wife was there, and Ramanuja's wife had already come and filled up her water jug, and she was about ready to leave when the guru's wife came, and she was lifting up water. While she was filling up her jug, one drop of water splashed into the jug of Ramanuja's wife, and then Ramanuja's wife started to chastise her like anything. "What do you think you're doing? You're from a low-class family. I'm from an aristocratic, higher Brahmin family, and your water has contaminated my water by falling from your pot to my pot. What do you think you're doing? Don't be puffed up just because you're the wife of the guru, that you think I have to respect you as Guru Mata or something, when you're coming from an inferior family lineage." Gone to this, really laid it into it, you're over some totally mundane appreciation of someone's family lineage. In the Brahmins, there's some higher Brahmins and lower Brahmins. But this all is smarta, or superficial consideration. Certainly, it was totally inappropriate and not very offensive. Instead of seeing the guru's wife as a Vaishnavi, instead of just respecting her as a Vaishnav, she was comparing herself to her on all mundane characteristics. So the guru's wife was a kind of soft-hearted, soft-spoken lady, and she just took her by shock, all the chastisement she was getting, and she was a little bit crying there. You know. Didn't protest or anything. Meanwhile, Ramu's wife takes her water pot and goes back. The guru comes back and sees his wife's completely, you know, shook up. What's happened? Explain what happens. And anyway, don't take it seriously. This is just the will of the Lord that we shouldn't stay here any longer. We should go back to Sri Rangam, and the Lord there must be waiting for us. And so they packed up their things, and immediately they just took off and went back to Sri Rangam. Meanwhile, Ramanuja was out giving classes or something, and he came back to the house with some present for the guru. And, well, in the meantime, what happened was another brahmana came. No, what happened? I went back to find to see the guru. Found the guru was gone. He asked his wife, "Where's the guru?" So once he had committed offense to the wife, then the second time he said, "Well, what kind of gurus you got nowadays? We heard the gurus are supposed to be great people. But just look at, I just happened to say a few harsh words to his wife. He came and got so offended by seeing his wife was, was a kind of sentimental girl. She was so affected by this. He got angry and just took off and went off to Sri Rangam." I mean, what kind of gurus you got nowadays? They get angry at a drop of a hat, you know, something like that. Ramanuja was shocked. You know, don't say all these things. This is an aparad, you know. Of course, that wasn't at all what the guru was thinking. This was her offensive mentality on what she thought the guru was thinking. The guru just took it. It's not favorable here, so that means the Lord must want us to go somewhere else. Okay, let's go. But he wasn't like angry or anything. He took it in stride. But she was like, second offense. I guess she had three chances. But then she was offending the guru, and that was really heavy for Ramanuja. Or maybe that was the second offense. But anyway, what happened? He went everywhere looking for the guru. Couldn't find. As he was coming, in the meantime, some brahmana comes back. Customary in those days, the mendicant brahmanas would go sometime, and if they came across the brahmana house, they would ask for some meal.
So those who were at houses who were established somewhere, it was customary, they would always give in charity. Like Ambarish Maharaj, he was the king doing a brata, but he was giving in charity to the brahmana. And so Ramanuja, who was an established brahmana, who was well-to-do, in that sense he had many students, many thousands of students. So if somebody came for prasadam, then automatically he would feed such brahmana. In this case, this brahmana, knowing the charity and the great Vaishnava quality of Ramanuja, comes to the house, and he's, the lady requests, he's kind of waiting there, and he just see if he'd get invited for prasad or something. Ramanuja's wife, she saw him standing there. She said, "What do you want? What do you think you're going to get here at this house? Coming here begging? Do you have anything better to do?" Something like, just like this guy on his case started screaming at him. "Get out of here," in those days, just like it was a household that was honored to be able to feed some brahmana. Here he's getting chastised. He didn't say anything. He just standing there, He went off and I came to Ramanuja's house and this happened. My goodness, what's the world coming to? So, he goes off, in a state of shock. Here the greatest Vaishnava in whole South India goes to his house and gets blasted by his wife just because he's standing there, seeing if he gets a little Mahaprasad. And so Ramanuja is really disturbed. All these things are happening. He comes back, sees this brahmana walking along, kind of like in a state of shock, totally fright. He said, "What's the matter? What happened? Where are you coming?" He said, "Oh, paid his obeisances. I came to your house hoping maybe I get a little Mahaprasadam." And just explained what his wife did, And then Ramanuja thought, and said, "Okay, one, two, three strikes, you're out." Whatever. And he said, "Okay, I got something for you to do." And he wrote a letter to his wife. He wrote a letter saying, "My dear daughter, or my dear Ramanuja," as if it was his father-in-law writing, "we're going to have a big wedding for your sister-in-law or whatever, and we really need your wife to come and help us. I want you to come also for this festivities. It's a lot of pressure on our whole household. So please come along with your wife. If you can come right now, then at least immediately send your wife with the bearer of this letter, so that she can help in all the household affairs of this big festival we're going to be putting on, and you come as quickly as possible. But without our daughter, it's very difficult to do all these things." Signed, signed his father-in-law. So maybe his wife didn't know how to recognize the handwriting of the father-in-law. I don't know. Anyway, then he gives that to the Brahmin and sends it, said, "You go and give this to my wife. Say you're the messenger of my father-in-law, and that he's given you this message, and he wants you to present this to Ramanuja, and then you'll get real nice prasadam and everything. You don't have to worry about anything." He figured out that his wife was not considering her relationship with Krishna, but her family and material relationship was totally identification. So the Brahmin goes back, "Should I have a message here from your father? It's for Ramanuja and me." "Oh, my father, yes, come in, you sit down here, take some, have a nice prasadam and everything," all based on bodily relation. Then Ramanuja comes back, and the wife says, "Look at it, my father sent you a letter." And then he reads it, "What does this letter say here?" "Oh, dear Ramanuja," and he reads out the whole letter real loud, "Okay, this is what it says. Well, I can't go right now. I have some really urgent things to take care of, but you can go with this brahmana. He'll take you to your father's house, and I'll be surely coming in a very short time." And then she's very happy to go see her family relatives again, packed her stuff, went off with the brahmana. And then Ramanuja thought, "Okay, I got to go somewhere quick." And then he went to the temple and had a big sacrifice arranged, and before the deity he took sannyas. Sent his wife back to the father, Haribol, and he took sannyas. So wife was protected, there were no children, and at a young age he took sannyas. So he had a beautiful wife, she was like a goddess, very materially beautiful, but Krishna consciously she wasn't able to help Ramanuja. Rather, what help he was trying to do, she's offending his guru, offending his guru's wife, sending the brahmanas who come there, who's next? How long can that? Although it happened in a very short time, but Ramanuja, he had a very big mission he wanted to achieve, and if his wife would cooperate, he wouldn't have left her, would have remained as a grihastha. So, like that, that's one example of how this principle has been practiced. Of course, once Ramanuja took sannyas, he didn't leave it. He lived over 120 years, and of course, he had tens of thousands of disciples, maybe hundreds of thousands. And I think, I forget the number, but it was either some like 600 sannyasi disciples, or maybe it was over 1,000, I forget, but maybe someone else remembers. But it was a huge number of devotees who took sannyas from him also. And of course he was preaching all over. At the same time, Ramanuja, he could appreciate when a grihastha was Krishna conscious. One time there was one grihastha wasn't a brahmana, who was very Krishna conscious. And all the brahmanas were complaining because he was giving this disciple so much mercy, putting his hand on his shoulder and walking with him sometimes. And they said, well, we are brahmanas, why are you associating so intimately with a non-brahmana? And this, that. And so Ramanuja didn't appreciate this kind of material vision. So Ramanuja Acharya, he either sent someone or he went and he ripped off in all the brahmanas. Everybody's dhotis are 6 yards, so he ripped off like 3-4 inches off each person's dhoti, took some of the kopins here and there from the sannyasis, and then went back to the ashram, and then there's such a huge thing. Who ripped my dhoti? Who took that cloth? And I was like, you know, yelling and screaming, and what's going on? Then he called, you know, someone took my kopin, I can't find it, and someone, you know, took my underwear, and someone ripped my cloth, and it's like, oh, and okay, this thing, and had to preach to him, cool down, it's all right, you know, I got 5 meters and 75 centimeters, you're just missing, you know, a few inches, it's all right, you know, life will go on. Had to preach to him and get everybody to, it was a huge thing because people got their kopin stolen, they wanted to know who stole their kopin. They got accusing that somebody else had someone else's, and getting into a whole fight over this underwears and dhoti. So then, Ramanuja, with this background, then he called the Brahman and said, okay, let's test these non-Brahmana grihasthas and see where they're really at. I want two of you Brahmanas to go, and they have a lot of rich jewelry, or golden jewelry, you go and steal their jewelry, see where it's at, see where they're, and we'll see how attached they are, where they're at. So that evening, before the husband came back, the Brahmana, two Brahmana disciples, they went and they somehow, they didn't know how to get in, so they snuck through the, took some of the roof tiles off and kind of lowered themselves down into the house. Meanwhile, waiting for her husband to come back, the wife of the house was kind of resting in her bed with her jewelry on. And then she wasn't really asleep, so she saw that, oh, the two Brahman disciples, godbrothers, disciples of my Guru Maharaj, they're coming. Wonder what they want. Maybe they're sent. I will let me just lie here and not disturb. They can have whatever they want. Because they're sneaking in, so maybe they're shy to ask for something. They want it directly, they just come and knock and ask. So then they see here the lady is sleeping, and she has all this gold jewelry, you know, worth fabulous amount. So they carefully take off half the jewelry. She's lying on half, so the other upper part, they take off the jewelry, and they think what to do, how to get the other half. And she's thinking that they must want the other half, so I roll over so they can get the other half. Guru must need the money or something. So then she kind of just, I guess they're sleeping. She rolls over and they freak out. Maybe she's waking up. They run, you know, run out of the house and go and hide. Then she's like lamenting, you know, they came and they couldn't give them the other half. They ran away. And the husband came and saw his wife. They're upset. What's the matter? And say, well, this happened, you know. These two disciples came and they explained the whole thing that happened. And then the husband started chastising her. This is because you thought it was yours to give. That you were giving the guru, you are having this false ego. Everything is already the guru's. If he wants, why you have to think that you are trying to give him? It's all the Krishna's property anyway. Because of your false ego, when you turned over, therefore they got scared and ran away, and you couldn't give everything to Krishna when he came for it. And then they're, oh, she was crying. Yes, I'm completely, you know, false ego. You know, they had a very high standard of. The Brahmins overheard all this that was happening, and then they couldn't believe it. You know, they went back and told Ramanuja. And then Ramanuja called the Brahmins and explained. And then he said, you know what happened a few days ago? You lost your dhoti ends and your kopins got mixed up. You sannyasis, you Brahmins. I personally had that done. So now you tell me, they lost their golden jewels and they're lamenting they couldn't give it all. It's all Krishna's property. In spite of having house and property and so many, they're thinking it's all Krishna's. And you, in spite of renouncing everything, living in an ashram, living as a renunciate,
somebody takes your dhoti or end or your kopan, and you're fighting with each other like children. So who is more brahminical? You or this Vaishnavas who are not born in a Brahmin family? And they all, you know, hung their head and said, no, they're much more brahminical than we were. And so in this way, Ramanuja taught them that how a Krishna conscious grihastha is glorious. And after that, nobody complained anymore when he gave his mercy to those grihasthas. So, like that, in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Leela, there's also many examples of most of Lord Chaitanya's followers were actually grihasthas. And the husband and wife both had equal quality, but because of having a different body, and for the sake of social example, for the sake of maintaining certain etiquette, they naturally would act differently. Like when Lord Chaitanya's devotees came from Bengal, sometimes they would bring their wives with them. And one description is there in Chaitanya Bhagavad, when they arrived in Jagannath Puri, one time suddenly Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan party was taking a Jagannath Deva Utsav Murti in a procession to the Narendra Sarovar, just as the devotees are coming from a side street for the first time after walking 500 kilometers to see them. And immediately they all bow down, seeing Lord Chaitanya suddenly, hearing the kirtan. And Lord Chaitanya, seeing his devotees, immediately he runs to them and they start embracing. And they're all crying in ecstasy. Lord Chaitanya and his associates in Jagannath Puri are crying. The Bengali, the devotees from Bengal, they're crying, embracing the Lord and touching his feet. And his wife, the wives of these associates, they're a little bit back at the distance, and they're also touching the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya, and in their heart they're embracing, but in their mind from a distance, in a spiritual sense, not in a material sense. And they were crying in ecstasy also, just meditating the lotus feet of the Lord. So everybody was crying in ecstasy, but to maintain the proper etiquette, Lord Chaitanya was a sannyasi, and so they were kept at a respectful distance. So in this way, you could see though that in sentiment and ecstasy and love of Krishna, they were both on the same level. There was no distinction that one will go back to Godhead and the other one won't. Or they're both fully Krishna conscious, but according to their situation, they would accordingly engage in the appropriate services. Srinivas Acharya, who was contemporary with Narottam Das Thakur, he was ordered by Narahari Thakur to accept the Grihastha Ashram. And his wife, he became a king's guru. His wife became Guru Mata. Narottam Das Thakur, on the other hand, he was a lifelong brahmachari, Maistiki brahmachari. But he practically, although a contemporary, he accepted Srinivas Acharya to be like his Shiksha Guru. In that sense, our older godbrother really respected him, considered him as a spiritual guide, not on the level of his initiating guru, but in a respectful way. In the bhajan we sing, he, along with the six Goswamis, he mentions Lokanath Goswami as initiating guru, but after that he says, Sri Acharya Doya Koro Prabhu Srinivas. That Sri Acharya, that Srinivas was known as Acharya because he was so expert in explaining the Bhagavatam and establishing the philosophy of the disciplic succession. So he gets given the title of Acharya, one who practiced what he preaches and who could dispel the doubts in the philosophy, etc. So although here he was in the renounced order, Narottam, and Srinivas is Grihastha, but he respected him. In much more recent times, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, who was superficially in the Grihastha ashram, was accepted as a guru by Gorkishordas Babaji, who was the most renowned, who was eating out of an empty skull and was completely, wearing just a kopan and engaging in devotional service and totally absorbed in the mood of separation of Krishna. So you can see that there is appreciation on the real level of Krishna consciousness for someone's Krishna consciousness, more than one's ashram. In this case, Ambarish Maharaj and his good wife are both fully Krishna conscious, engaging in their devotional service as husband and wife, and they were equally glorious. Durvasa Muni, who was a mental son of Lord Brahma, who was a great mystic, who was he was not able to appreciate their transcendental position, considering them to be ordinary mundane grihasthas. He
created some offense against Ambarish, and as a result, of course, his whole pastime is being explained, how he had to suffer for that, and how he was given the realization of the actual position of the Vaishnavas. So to be a spouse of a Vaishnava is a very big responsibility for both husband and wife, to remain Krishna conscious, to not allow the relationship to come down simply to a mundane level, which is going to create a situation like a jungle in the house. That's why Chanakya said, what's the difference? Living in the jungle. In those days, you take sannyas, means you go and live in the jungle and just chant and do your meditation. Of course, that's been really forbidden in the Kali Yuga. So now it's recommended to take vanaprastha or to live in the ashram. Because living in the forest and stopping activity is not very easy and not recommended in the age of Kali. Better to just simply engage directly in a temple in devotional service. So grihasthas need to engage themselves in Krishna conscious activities and keep the house with Krishna in the center. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wrote a song in this regard, and he also explained that how one day he was in his house and he kept Krishna in the center of his household, was worshipping Krishna, and one day he actually realized Krishna in the house. He could see how Krishna was in his house, how everyone was being engaged in Krishna's service, but not, you know, just a theoretical, but he could actually realize Krishna in the house and see that his house had become the spiritual world with Krishna there. And there's a song about this ecstasy in that regard. This is actually the objective. Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Navhata, he said that when you have a husband and wife cooperatively serving and establishing like this a Krishna conscious household, he called that Asraddha Kuti. Literally, it means a cottage of pure faith in Krishna. But it was like a basic unit of the Namhat. He had many individual members, but he considered Asraddha Kuti to be an important aspect. So we're trying in India and different parts to establish these Asraddha Kutis, or houses of faith, where the whole family is centered in Krishna. Sometimes here in the West or in the modern circumstance, it doesn't work out. People are already married before and one's not equally interested in Krishna consciousness as the other, so it's a difficult situation for them to practice their Krishna consciousness. Of course, artificially they don't just give up, but you can see they're under a lot of stress, in the sense of trying to make your family Krishna conscious when the whole team is not into it. So there's a lot of difficulty for that. But when everybody is cooperating, then it's a very ideal situation. So that's the actual definition of a grihastha. Bhakti Vinod Thakur showed the example. Many other great acharyas showed the example. Prahlad Maharaj, he personally explained the difference also between grihastha and grihamedi. That grihamedi sukham hi tuchham. The happiness of a materialistic household life is like insignificant. Tuchham is like something, you know. In fact, that you can like despise that kind of happiness. But the happiness that a real grihastha achieves is the happiness, the ecstasy of pure Krishna consciousness, which is completely transcendental. So if everyone is eager to achieve that Krishna consciousness and working cooperatively, serving, so then that's a very glorious household. And if the center is sense gratification, then it's a grihamedi. And that type of happiness that they'll achieve some material happiness, and then along with that, some material frustration. But Prahlad Maharaj's opinion is that tuccha. It's really despicable or insignificant kind of happiness. Just drop in the desert. Now there's so many troops from Britain and America and Europe and the Middle East, and they're supposed to drink gallons of water every day. So you can imagine someone there in the 100 degree plus heat of the desert. You know, you give them here, have a teaspoon of water. It's not going to satisfy their thirst. They have to take, you know, liters and gallons of water to just stay alive. In material life, yes, there's happiness. But actually that happiness, compared to what we need to really be peaceful and to be satisfied, is just like taking, you know, a few drops in the desert. So we can, maybe this was like real theoretical for people in Europe before, but now you can read in the papers how they're suffering. Recently when some big official went there, and their soldiers were saying, try some hot water, because all the drinking water is warm. So there's no way you can refrigerate all the water. So everything's hot, including the water. So even they drink the glass of water, it's not like the cool water. It's hot. Everything's hot. So if you don't get enough water, well, there's no peace. So that's the situation. You don't, people in the material world, they may have the big house, they may have all the facilities, but if they're not Krishna conscious, it's dry. They try to juice it up, have their parties, have their this, have their social events, but ultimately there's not complete satisfaction. Therefore, there's also other problems that develop in trying to find satisfaction, so they have affairs, or they have this, they have different scandals going on. So if our avenue to be happy is focused on the senses, then we're going to get dragged into all kind of tamasic things, rajasic things. We're going to be dragged away from Krishna. But if the focus is very clearly on being God-conscious and being Krishna-conscious and getting our satisfaction by pleasing Krishna, by Him being pleased, then we become pleased. Then that is the real transcendental position. In that circumstance, both husband and wife are equally glorified. They're both on the transcendental platform. So here the word is used, tulya silaya, equally qualified. So also in this verse, the glories of following Ekadasi is given. Apparently everyone didn't always observe Ekadasi equally, but that was observed in order to please Krishna. So here Maharaj Ambarish for 1 year strictly observed all the 52, or how, you know, 52 weeks in the year, taking that, maybe Vedic is 1 or 2 weeks less. All the weeks in the year, all the fortnights, so the 26 Ekadasis in a year generally. And Dwadasi. Ekadasi means that actually one starts the day before and if you want to strictly observe the ritualistic Ekadasi, then it's a 3-day process. The day before you don't eat after your main noon meal, then you don't eat it heavily again in the night before. So you don't, if you do the strict like ritualistic fast, then after you rise in the morning of Ekadasi, Mangal Arti time, Brahma Muhurta, then the whole day you don't take rest. The whole night you keep vigil, chanting Hare Krishna, discussing only Krishna Katha, chanting. And then the next morning, you take paran on Dwadasi. And you have to take it, the paran, before the stipulated time, which is after sunrise, and there's astrologically some period which is fixed, varies between 7:30 to 9:30, usually. In some cases, it's pretty close to the sunrise. And then the next day, you're not also supposed to sleep until the next night. So practically, you know, from Mangal Arati to the next day after that, the evening time, you don't take any rest. The whole time you're in vigil chanting. That's a strict way of following this Ekadasi, Dwadasi, Vrata. So even on Dwadasi, you don't take rest again. Of course, normally this type of, I don't know how many actually keep vigil for the whole period, which is the actual, if you want to do it in that sense, Nirjala, you have to do the Nirjala is this way. Nirjala for and staying vigil the whole time. Not that right after Mangal Arati you go and take rest after sunrise and sleep on Dwadasi. Can't sleep on Dwadasi either. So it was an austerity. Srila Prabhupada, of course, Lord stressed that the most important aspect of Ekadasi, we don't need to follow, it's not obliged, one has to follow this ritualistic way. But at least one shouldn't take any grains, beans, pulses on the Ekadasi day, and one should increase the chanting and hearing on that day. But I just, because maybe everyone knew what the actual system of, if you want to do Nirjala, it's actually like entails 3 days. It's just like people follow Chaturmasya, and sometimes in India everybody grows their beards, but Prabhupada said if you're going to follow it on that level, then you follow it also that you only eat once a day grains, and that you just take this type of khichdi without salt. No salt, no, you know, spices for that time. We did that for 2 years. I did as a younger sannyasi in Mayapur. And of course, in the end, we say it was more important to preach. Now on the rainy season, I come all over the West. I'm just coming now. The rainy season's over. I'm going back to India. Now for rainy season, I go to South America and America, Europe. preach for a month or two. That's more important than growing a beard and eating unspiced khichdi and chanting a lecture. Although, if you're going to do the austerity, then Prabhupada suggests you do it fully. Don't just grow the beard and show everybody doing austerity, but you're eating like normal. If you're going to do that, you know, okay, the whole purpose is you're not going to worry about your body, so you're not going to eat luxuriously, you're not going to grow, you're not also going to cut your hair, you're just going to spend as much time possible chanting. That was the purpose of this type of austerity. And in those days, there's no paved roads, so in the rainy season, nobody could move, so the sannyasis and the preachers, they were traveling preachers, just sit, because you couldn't walk. It'd be raining everywhere, it'd be mud everywhere, it'd be like, if you go in a village now, when it's rainy season, all the bullock carts are moving on these dirt roads, you have to practically wade up to your waist in mud, because the mud gets so thick. So kind of traveling around is like, for any distance, is really impractical during that season. So it became a custom to just sit for 4 months and do this austerity and chant, and that still followed. But Prabhupada, he saw that many of these things were not as important as just preaching Krishna consciousness. So he would also just follow the basic minimum for Chaturmasya. No spinach first month, no yogurt, no milk, and no herd dal or high protein on the last month. And chant Hare Krishna. But he would also travel and preach during the Chaturmasya, considering the circumstance. So Prabhupada maintained the respect for the Vedic systems and Vedic traditions to help us be Krishna conscious. At the same time, utility is the principle, preaching is the essence. He would, according to the circumstances, he would give more priority to preaching. I remember we went to Vrindavan to see Srila Prabhupada. We had our beards and everything. We were doing the tapasya. And then it was almost like the last week before the end of Kartik. So we just one more week would have completed the chapter of Mass. And then Prabhupada called us in and it had spread out like a big mahaprasad, all kind of prasad. And said, take prasad. Finished, you know. We had to do it Prabhupada said. At least that's what his secretary said. I never got it straight, but whether he got sabotaged. But anyway, Prabhupada, he told us, if you're going to do it this way. But when we did it, it didn't really give very much. He didn't give any recognition because we were doing the austerity. But he gave much more recognition when devotees came from Eastern Europe or from somewhere, gave the reports on how many books were distributed. So we could understand that more important than these austerities was actually giving people Krishna consciousness. As we read this morning in the verse that was read out after Mangal Arati, that in this age, it's more important to engage in the Sankirtan Yajna. That is the real purification. Now the marathon of book distribution is going to be starting very soon. And engaging in the Sankirtan Yajna is an austerity. It's cold. Sometimes people are friendly, sometimes they're not. But engaging in giving people the Sankirtan mercy, that is more important and more glorious for this age, more purifying than doing simply some austerities. But in previous ages, these austerities were considered very important and purifying. But now, neither we can do the austerities very nicely. While doing it, our mind may become disturbed otherwise. And it's more important. The need in the world today is more to give people Krishna consciousness. And whatever the austerity of chanting, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare, and spreading the Hare Nam, that purifies us through this chanting, the power of the holy name. And the effect of austerity is purity, to have purity. So that purity is anyway achieved in a more sublime way, and one quickly gets the mercy. In previous ages there also was chanting, but the offenses to the holy name were something difficult to overcome. So people were afraid of these offenses. But while in this age, by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he is protecting us from these offenses to the holy name. So before we chant Hare Krishna, we take shelter of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and we chant Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gurudhar Sivasari Gaur Bhakti Vrinda. Hare Krishna. Any questions? Yes? Of course, even as a sannyasi, there's occasions when Lord Chaitanya would preach to. Of course, he would preach to women, but generally, women wouldn't be alone, they'd be with their husbands. I don't know of any of him preaching to a woman individually. But he would preach to men and women together. There was mixed groups, but he maintained very strictly the separation. The women would touch his lotus feet or would go close. They wouldn't come like within a yard or meter of Lord Chaitanya. And Lord Chaitanya was living in a time when it was very orthodox, and the society also was very orthodox. And we can take examples more, a little closer to us, from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was also lifelong sannyasi. One time, some Maharaji wanted to speak with him alone. He said, "I want to tell you something in private." But he refused. He said that, "No, these are all confidential people. You can speak in front of them." So the principle that one shouldn't be alone with a woman is to be very, of course, you shouldn't sit alone, even as a grihastha, even with another woman than your wife in a solitary place. One shouldn't be at all alone with a woman without one be alone as a sannyasi. So we've seen that there's been casualties, especially when sannyasis would preach to women alone in the room. Sometimes, you know, like, well, they leave the door open. You're talking with a person, the door's open, people can walk by, but you're still talking. The point is, you shouldn't be alone with a woman if you're a sannyasi. You have to have someone else in the room at all times. It may be sometimes difficult when some woman wants to talk to a spiritual master who's maybe a sannyasi, to have someone else in the room, but that's the austerity that has to be practiced. You know, you can pick who you want in the room, but to a certain degree. You can't be alone with the sannyasi in the room, because it's like a kind of a transgression of the vow of the sannyas to be in that situation. It's more dangerous. So that's how it's been applied. That's how it's been applied recently. Because now there are, you know, many women that are married. They want some spiritual guidance, so we preach to women also. But if someone's in the renounced order of life, a brahmachari or sannyasi, then he can't be in the room alone. As someone told me, I was just in Houston. It happened that a phone call came, and he said, "There's a phone call for you in the office." I went to the office, opened the door, and there in the office, there's nobody in the office but just one Maharaji sitting there. So I couldn't go in. I couldn't go in and get the phone. I had to go get another man or somebody to come with me, go in, I could get the phone. She was eating, so I didn't want to tell her to leave when she was eating. So that's just, you know, that's part of the etiquette we have to follow. And externally and mentally, you have to follow the etiquette of controlling your mind, not allowing the mind to dwell on any kind of improper thoughts, certainly not to act on any improper thoughts. So that's how we observe it today. We don't, because we do have to preach, and if you're in a public place or something, you can preach. We keep the talks. There's many advice also. Jagananda Pandit, he advised that talks, it's in Prabhupada's books as well, that talks with women, for those who are brahmacharis or sannyasis, should be simply related to Krishna service. Not just like light social talks. Certainly not laughing or joking together on some mundane platform. Just kept to Krishna consciousness. Is that all right? Right, but what the brahmachari has the option to become a grihastha, but there's a certain etiquette involved with wearing the saffron cloth, which sometimes I think devotees in the West not wearing that. Like in India, bhaktas aren't given saffron when they take initiation. The brahmachari is allowed to wear saffron. In some of the Gaudiya Math, you don't get saffron until you're kind of really fixed that you want to be a brahmachari for an indefinite period. And if somebody, but we do follow in this kind of, if a brahmachari thinks that he wants to get married in the future, then, immediate future, he's actively engaged in the process of the preliminary things to getting married, like, negotiations and so on. They don't wear saffron, they wear white. So we also follow the similar system that we give the respect to the saffron. This is a renounced cloth. Somebody's wearing saffron, they can't, shouldn't be like engaging in some kind of negotiation for getting married. If they think that I want to get married and I want to get married, you know, I'm in the state where right now I'm ready to get married, it's just a question of finding the proper person, and they're meditating like that, it's not appropriate to be wearing saffron, kind of be looking around, you know, who's their potential mate. They say that the biggest offense that Ravana made was that he kidnapped Sita in a sannyasi's court. If he had just kidnapped her as a kshatriya, it wasn't a big offense. Because kshatriyas, they do stuff like that. They kidnap other people's wives. They were like, you know, especially if you're a rakshasa, I mean, it's like, what do you expect? But he went as a sannyasi and cheated Sita, presenting himself in the renounced order like a wolf in lamb's cloth. And because of that, that was a bigger offense. That's why he had to be eliminated. So we don't want to be Ravana's, you know, dressing in saffron, but planning, you know, trying to use that to be able to get closer to women, because they disrespect a renounced person. So I can just go for some spiritual guidance when that person's actually thinking in another way. Last question. Prabhupada also answers this question in the, because I'm just reading what the purport said, but Prabhupada in another purport, he explained the duties of the wife is to serve the husband, but in the purport he said it's not that the wife has to be a slave to an un-Krishna conscious husband. That in case the husband becomes fallen, she doesn't have to serve a fallen husband, but she has the right to take shelter of the father. Just like Ramanuja sent his wife back to the father. And in our situation, the disciple would take shelter of the guru, spiritual father, engage in devotional service in a temple or in some situation like that. There are some rare cases, like Prabhupada's sister, she took the austerity of staying with the husband and following very strictly in her house, worshipping her deity, following all the principles, even though her husband was good. He felt for 3 years he was drinking and doing bad activities. Then by his wife's determination, he could realize his mistake and he went back to the proper path. This is really above the call of duty. It's like, you know, we probably get a special award for bravery above and beyond the call of duty. It's not that a wife has to do that. And if you do it, you have to be Krishna conscious. There's no use of doing it if the wife also falls in Maya. Then it was both are lost. She could do it and remain Krishna conscious even in that situation. She had her deities. She cooked for herself, vegetarian and everything, even though her husband, you know, he was really fallen for 3 years, started becoming non-veg, everything. So if a wife thinks she can save her husband and still be Krishna conscious, which I think is very difficult for most women in the context today, but if some, there are examples that some people have done that, but they had to remain themselves Krishna conscious, otherwise it was used. But according to Srila Prabhupada, a woman is not obliged to them. She can take shelter of her spiritual father and wait for the husband to be Krishna conscious enough to be able to serve him as a Vaishnava. Hare Krishna.